The Office of the State Historian is proud to present the New Mexico Digital History Project podcast series.
Thank you, Dennis, and everyone for being here, and to all the archivists again. I know that Esteban already mentioned this, but it's so crucial that the archivists are as helpful as they are in this process. When the other scholars here know that when you go in there and they say, so tell me a little bit about your project, and you think that you know everything that you want to look up, and then they say, actually, there's this unprocessed box that isn't on the website. Let me show it to you real quick, or something like that. Things that you wouldn't have thought of. So it's essential, their help, as well as Esteban and Dennis's help in this whole process and the funding itself. So thank you very much. To everyone involved in that. And thank you for taking your lunch hour to come and hear what I have to say about Mexican-American, Chicana, Chicano environmental writing. And basically what I'm going to do is I have an overview of my talk here, tell you a little bit about my overall project, which is this book that I'm working on, which was my dissertation, Walden Pond in Aztlan, a literary history of environmental writing of Chicanas and Chicanos, 1848 to the present. It could have been a lot earlier. My time span could go all the way back to the 16th century, but I chose to use that end of the Mexican-American War as my beginning point, basically because I was in graduate school and I had to finish at some point, right? So I couldn't go all the way back to the 16th century, but I'm hoping to recruit graduate students who can help me fill in all the gaps, because there's lots of gaps here. So I'll tell you a little bit about that project, including a couple of examples. Tell you just a tiny bit about the work that I've done overall in the archives, and then give you a more in-depth example of what I'm talking about in terms of what an environmental writer means, or what a Mexican-American environmental writer is, how I'm using that term, and what it brings to both the writer's work and to our knowledge about environmental thought. So that's my brief outline. So a little bit about my project. Why environmental writing? Is that better? Okay. Why environmental writing? Why Mexican-American writing? Why do this kind of crossover? Why hasn't anybody done it before? Lots of questions there, right? Well, basically, for Mexican-American writing, for Chicana and Chicano writing, thinking about the environment in these texts really sheds new light on these texts. You can read these novels, this poetry, these memoirs with a completely new perspective. It brings out new things, and I'll show you that with the example of Ruiz de Burton in a couple of minutes. But the other thing that I have highlighted here in yellow that I think is more exciting is the lessons that Mexican-American environmental thought brings to environmental studies overall. There is some scholarly work on Mexican-American contributions to environmental thought. It's mostly in the social sciences and anthropology, geography, not very much in literature. And at the same time that there's the beginnings of that scholarship, in the environmental movement itself, there's a lot of call for diverse participation, right? The environmental movement sees itself as very white and middle class and doesn't like that, right? It's saying that they're not satisfied with that, that they want to attract more diversity, but don't quite know how, right? And I think by recovering some of the environmental thought in these texts, especially historical texts, right, not just the contemporary stuff, but the historical stuff, can show that recruiting diverse voices for the environment is not anything new, that diverse peoples, Mexican-Americans, African-Americans, Asian-Americans, many others, have been thinking about the environment in creative ways for a very long time. We just have to dredge it up, so to speak, right? It's there. We just have to start paying attention to it. And if we start doing that, then there's going to be more of a of a consistent kind of follow-through in recruiting diverse voices to the environmental movement. Some of the work that's been done to recruit diverse voices is very contemporary, too. It has to do with environmental justice, which is definitely very important to pay attention to, toxicity, inner city, urban nature, things like that. But I'd like to stay away from kind of pigeonholing Mexican-American or African-American voices into these more contemporary times, right, that there is this historical depth as well. So that's part of why I'm very interested in what's going on in New Mexico and doing this historical work here. And just as one example of historical depth in this project and how environmental thought sheds light on Mexican-American writing and how Mexican-American writing sheds light on the environment, I have one example here from 1885. Does anybody know the work of Ruiz de Burton? One, two, a couple? Yeah, she's a very, very interesting novelist from the late 19th century, the first Mexican-American to publish in English, a whole novel in English. Her first novel was in 1872. And I look at her 1885 novel, The Squatter and the Dawn, because it's set in California in 1872, following the U.S.-Mexican War, following the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo that guarantees land rights. And it's in that period of transition where there's a lot of squatters on land, on Mexican-American land, and a lot of Mexican-American land grants are lost. So she's documenting this in a novel, right? And the novel has been explored a lot for its political statements, for its depiction of women, for its depiction of Spanish American identity, but not so much about the relationship to the land, the longstanding relationship to the land that she depicts there. In particular, the don of the hacienda, Don Mariano, talks about ways that he's proposing to the squatters that they use the land for vineyards and for fruit orchards instead of for planting wheat like the squatters want to do. And he's willing to compromise with the squatters and give them some land if they're willing to stop killing his cattle and stop planting wheat, right? But they reject him on cultural terms. They say that we can't transition to that. We're really wheat farmers. That's our identity, right? So just that one scene kind of shows you how taking an environmental look really sheds new light on the novel, and also shows a longstanding relationship with the land from a Mexican-American cultural point of view. Okay, so that's taken a lot longer than I meant it to, but I wanted to give you kind of an overview. My current project, in terms of my research in the archives, covers all of these writers, and I was just speaking with Esteban at the beginning of the lecture and saying there's a lot more there that I want to cover, but I've basically looked at the archives of all of these writers and found a lot to work with and made tons of copies. And what I'm choosing to speak to you about is the project that I have kind of more developed, right, up until this period. And it's a project that I started with, Adelina Otero Warren and her works here at the State Archives. But I have, as a slash, Estela Berger Leopold, because she's the one that really brought me here to the State Archives and to her sister, Nina. So how many of you know Nina Otero Warren? Just to get an idea. Okay, so a lot of you. How about Estela Berger Leopold? Yeah, a couple of you knew his her husband. Yeah. How many of you know Aldo Leopold? Yeah, so there's this whole mixture going on here, and I first found out that Estela Leopold, I didn't know the Berger part, was from New Mexico, and I thought, oh, I wonder if she's
She's Mexicana, the way that I think of it to myself is she's Latina. And then I found out about her sister, and I thought, well, I want to go and check out the papers, see if there are any writings from Estela, because I'm sure that her partnership with Aldo Leopold, who's considered by many the father of the modern conservation movement, that there was some exchange there, right? I mean, you can't be partners with having some exchange there. So that's a kind of a tangential project, but looking into Estela's papers, I found Nina, and I found her wonderful book, Old Spain and Our Southwest, and I thought, well, I have to take a closer look at that. So the main thing I'm going to talk to you about is an analysis that I have of just the first essay in Old Spain and Our Southwest. So, am I going too fast? Is this okay? No questions so far? All right. Since many of you know Nina Otero Warren, I'll just kind of breeze through this background, but I wasn't sure that everyone would, so I thought I'd just throw this slide up there. Of course, she's the daughter of two old and prominent New Mexico families. She was married for only 2 years, but kept his name. Some people argue that that was in order to have both her old Spanish family name and to have an Anglo-American name, and it's kind of symbolic of her role as a cultural broker between the Spanish-American culture and the Anglo-American culture in New Mexico. And she let it be known or didn't correct the rumor that she was a widow instead of a divorcee. She was a leader of the New Mexico suffrage movement, a superintendent of schools. She almost wins a seat in Congress in 1922, very soon after women are allowed to vote in New Mexico, is an inspector of Indian services and a real estate agent, and even has her own ranch. And after Aldo Leopold's San Calni Almanac is published, she refuses to have any grazing on the Las Dos Ranch, right, following some of his recommendations. She's a very prominent New Mexican woman, very influential, but not really considered very much as a writer, right? Her activism is very important, her standing in the community very important, but not considered very much as a writer. So this is what I'm interested in. Okay, so she is writing in a very vital period, I think, in Mexican-American writing, identity, cultural knowledge, right? She is participating in this movement of Spanish-American identity, right, in the early 20th century, creating a link to the past. But she's a more of a progressive voice in terms of the Spanish-American identity, using it as a strategy to preserve cultural knowledge. That's what I would argue. Asserting the Mexican-American, Spanish-American cultural knowledge. She sees it as a strategy to keep that going, right? And she writes this book in 1936. She publishes it in 1936 and is encouraged for many years by Mary Austin to write something about her culture, right, as an authentic voice. And she eventually gets around to doing this along with everything else that she's been doing, right, that I've shown you up here. And as part of her role as superintendent of schools in Santa Fe County, she sees that there's just not a lot of material for young people to have an entry to their own culture. So it's kind of targeted to a youth audience, and if you've read it, you can tell that it is targeted to more of a youth audience. It has a kind of authoritative tone, right? These kind of short chapters, very picturesque kind of descriptions. It's a joy to read, but you can tell that it's targeted more at a youth audience, right? And these are just some of the titles to give you a flavor of it. An Old Spanish Hacienda, Asking for the Bride, The Harvest, Spanish Place Names, right? So she's kind of running the gamut. One reviewer said, oh, well, she's gone all over the place. You can tell that she didn't know She couldn't decide among all of the riches what she was going to focus on. So it was kind of a backhanded compliment, right? But she does kind of give the whole tour, right? Because she wants to give the young people an idea of a holistic culture. Now I'll tell you a little bit about some of the
reception. I found a lot in the archives. I found a lot of kind of short reviews at the time that it came out. They were very complimentary. This is a good resource. This is well written, things like that. But there's been some more kind of scholarly, serious critique of the book. One from 1938 and one from 1982. A.L. Campa, who was at the University of New Mexico at the time that he wrote his review, it's far too subjective and it emphasizes the spiritual life of New Mexican culture. As if emphasizing the spiritual life of New Mexican culture was a bad thing, and he goes into that a little bit earlier in his review. But overall, it's just far too subjective for his taste. And this is the last line in the review, so it's the taste that he wants to leave in your mouth for the book, right? So not too hot about it. And in 1982, Raymond Paredes, who is to be complimented, of course, for including this at all in his work on Chicano authors, but he does critique it pretty soundly, right? He finds it profoundly disturbing. Overall, the early 20th century literature of New Mexico, he says, literature created out of fear and intimidation, a defensive response to racial prejudice, right? Not really encouraging professors of Chicano literature to include it on your syllabus, I would say, right? And then a little later, in 1989, Diana Rebolledo, who I should thank as well, who wrote me a letter of recommendation for this fellowship, tries to recover this a bit, right? And I think successfully does. She's writing about not only Nina Otero Warren, but Cleofas Jaramillo and Fabiola Cabeza de Vaca. And about Otero Warren in particular, she says, "This is an early attempt to preserve in literary images a vanishing way of life." And then I've highlighted, I think it is of particular importance and relevance to this talk. She communicates to us her growing sense of disjunction from the landscape, illustrating her feeling of alienation and isolation in a time of transition. So you can feel already there's a lot more to this book, to this work, than anyone else has given it credit for, right? And that last quote from Rebolledo is about this first chapter in particular that I'm going to talk to you about. So let me get on to doing that. Okay, so the opening chapter is called "The Wind in the Mountains." Actually, the original title was "El Aire en las Montañas." Have the original draft here somewhere. So I found the original draft in the archives, and I was really excited when I did, because it was not terribly marked up when I got it, but you could tell it was an original draft. You know, it's kind of the yellowy paper and stuff, original typescript. I've since marked it up quite a bit, but it's just a copy, so don't worry. So it was originally called El Aire en las Montañas, and then The Wind in the Mountains in parentheses, right? And this chapter, which is the opening chapter, and which I think in a lot of ways is the most sophisticated piece of writing in the whole book, it's as if she's challenging her readers to take this as the framing device. And then the rest of it is really for the teenagers that she's writing to, right, the young adults that she's writing to. But hey, you teachers who are going to read this, or others in the community are going to read this, take note of this. I really am a more sophisticated writer. I'm just writing the rest of it for younger audiences, right? But there's a lot more going on here. So she's signaling us here with this opening chapter. And she draws this parallel between Spanish culture and the natural environment. This is something that Rebolledo has already drawn our attention to. But let me just read you the last paragraph to give you the sense of the
of the essay. So overall, this essay is set on her ranch, Las Dos, and she's alone in her little adobe. She says one part that's not included in the final published version. She says, "My not too well built adobe casita, the wind penetrates, right?" So she's sitting there alone, and the storm comes. And she's narrating to you the experience of sitting through a storm in her house alone on top of a hill, right? And so that's one key element. The other key element is that outside, she observes from her window, from inside her house, from inside her protection, she observes outside there's a shepherd who is spending the night nearby where she can see them. With his sheep, and then at the end, an Indian enters, and you're going to get that that scene here. So that's the gist of it. It's just 3 pages long, and I'll read you the last paragraph. "As the shepherd was extinguishing the campfire, there appeared on the top of the hill a form with arms stretched to heaven as though offering himself to the sun. The shepherd from his camp and I from my window watched this half-clad figure that seemed to have come from the earth to greet the light. A chant, a hymn. The Indian was offering his prayer to the rising sun. The shepherd, accustomed to his Indian neighbors, went his way slowly, guiding his sheep out of the canyon. The Indian finished his offering of prayer. I alone seemed not in complete tune with the instruments of God. I felt a sense of loss, that they were closer to nature than I, more understanding of the storm. I had shuddered at the wind as it came through the cracks of my little house. Now I had to cover my eyes from the bright rays of the sun, while my neighbors, fearing nothing, welcomed with joy another day." So you get this sense that she is alienated from the natural environment, right? And of course, my initial reaction is, oh, but the others, the lower class, are, and the native subject are the ones that are closer to nature, and I'm the one that is distanced, right? So she's mourning this passing of her closeness to the natural environment, right? But it's written as if there was a time when she was closer to the natural environment, right? There was a before, and this is the after, right? So let me just share with you what Rebolledo says in response to this paragraph. "Otero remains on the edge, longing for the sense of integration denied her, in part because she is a woman, but also because she represents a culture and class undergoing a profound transition." So not only is she talking about the passing of this closeness to nature, she's also talking about the passing of a particular culture that could be closer to nature. And it's as if the storm symbolizes this transition in culture, right? That's my argument. If you're not convinced yet, let me show you a little more. I've already talked about this. It's a little different tone, a wistful tone, as if she's talking about something that's already passed, right? She wants a closer relationship. She's mourning something that's past, right? And I think that it's also a veiled reference to the dominance of Anglo-American culture and a note of rebellion and complaint. So let me show you a little bit what I mean. And I can elaborate this argument a little more because I have this original draft, because I know what's been taken out to clean it up for publication, right? I see what she was really trying to do and then what she eventually got to do, right? Because in the publication process, we always have to compromise, right? But the things that she had to compromise, I think, are particularly interesting and symbolic. For example, in the original draft, the title was in Spanish. The published draft has an English title only. The original draft, Spanish words are used throughout. They're sprinkled in, quotes from the shepherd, things that she's saying. And in the published draft, there aren't any words in Spanish, even though she translated them immediately afterwards in the original draft, right? But they weren't allowed to stick around. And then she has this warning in the original draft that doesn't show up in the published draft. As she's talking about the coming of the storm, she says, "This great Southwest is beautiful beyond words, but it needs to be watched lest it bruise those not acquainted with its moods." Well, this seems like, okay, well, it's an evaluation of the swiftness with which the weather can come down upon us. I drove through periodic showers as I was coming from Albuquerque, right? If you're caught in a wash and there's a rainstorm, you might get washed away, right, in an arroyo. But there seems to be more here, right? And something that an editor didn't like made the editor take it out, right? Is she talking about the storm that, the Anglo-American storm that came to influence the culture there, that challenged the Mexican-American culture that was in place there? Is she talking about the Mexican-American culture that if you don't watch it can sneak up on you and be more intimidating than you think? Something is there, right? And another passage that was edited, she's describing the storm itself. "Down crash the dead branches, the wind striking the tips of those more obstinate, with the weird sound of a musical instrument out of tune, like the crash of drums and cymbals emphasizing a strain of music while an idol fell to the ground." So that last part about the idol falling to the ground was taken out. There were some changes that were made in the essay that I could see were just stylistic, that the editor was really kind of helping her not be repetitive or be too wordy or something like that. But I think this is a significant passage that was taken out, this falling of an idol, right, that might have been some of her commentary about the passing of the Spanish-American culture, which suggests that she's perhaps a little more critical of it than she's been giving credit for, right? So this is my argument, as I've said, that the storm can symbolize in this essay the impact of an Anglo-American culture on the Spanish-American culture, on the dominance of that Spanish-American culture. And I'd like to draw a parallel to you, and this is in the essay as it's published. This is not about the draft that I found, but just my analysis of the published essay. "Before the storm, she has a feeling of vastness, of solitude, as you can imagine out there on the ranch, right, in her little adobe, but never of loneliness," she says. That's before the storm. "After the storm," she says, "I felt a loneliness not apparent in those more understanding of the aftermath of the storm, the shepherd and the Indian." She's more lonely in her disconnection from nature and the passing of Spanish-American culture. It's like she's acknowledging that she has made some compromises herself that keeps her distant, right? That she didn't have that distance before, that loneliness. But then she sneaks in this little bit about a candle. And I was reading and I thought, what about this candle? What's going on with this candle? I think it's her implying that there's some hope. Before the storm, again, she's saying, "A melancholy candle flickered as if gasping for breath before expiring," right? And she's comparing it to the fireplace. And that can be seen as what she sees as the struggling Spanish-American culture, right? "And after the storm, the fire has gone out in the fireplace. But of the candle," she says, "an unmuffled candle, alone illuminated the small room. It kept vigilance through the stormy night." So that melancholy candle makes it through the storm, even though the fire in the fireplace goes out. So, and my last argument about how she's really kind of sneaking in more of a cultural critique in this essay is that she is asserting the importance of Spanish language. And if you go to Rosina's lecture tomorrow, she's talking about Spanish, the politics of language, in particular Spanish in New Mexico for her research. For one thing, she tried to include more Spanish in the essay overall, right? That's pretty clear. And then there's this one sentence that could be just a cast off, but I think there's more to it. The night was alive with sounds of creatures less fearful than humans, speaking a language little understood by us, yet felt by every sense. So there are these creatures of the night that are speaking a language. She doesn't understand it, but she's saying, I'm not scared of it. I can feel what they're talking about. I feel that in every sense, even though I don't understand it. And the last thing I'm going to be is intimidated by a language that I don't understand. So why should others of us be intimidated of a language that we don't speak or that we don't understand, right? Asserting the importance of keeping Spanish around, right? So that's my overall argument about... One last point, actually. This book, Old Spain and Our Southwest, has been regarded as, okay, she's a product of her time, and she's celebrating the Spanish past, and Paredes' terms, we should not give it too much credit. In Rebolledo's terms, let's understand it for what it is and see what else is important of it. But I think she's perhaps a little more critical of that period than we might give her credit for. And I drew your attention to this passage, an idol falling to the ground. Perhaps she's implying that old hierarchies are no longer as viable as they might once have been. She isn't really imagining that we could go back to that period, but she wants to document that it existed, right? And in the next essay, which is the longest essay in the book about an old Spanish hacienda, at the beginning she's kind of setting the stage for what happens on the hacienda, right? And she says, she's talking about different roles. She's describing the building, and she's telling us about the windows. And she says, you could see everything that you needed to see from inside, from the windows. Never did anyone but peones expose themselves to the sun. So the higher class stayed inside. The peones were the ones who went outside and exposed themselves to the sun. But if you recall the exact previous essay, she's lamenting the fact that there was this disjunction between nature and humans. So she's lamenting this distance herself. Maybe she's being critical at that moment. Not just celebratory. And you have to take into account that at this period, it was hard to be that radical and still get published, right? So this is one of the periods that I think is the most interesting for that reason, right? I've done some work on Jovita Gonzalez in Texas, who's publishing at the same general time period, and she has to sneak in a lot of things this way, too. So I think it makes it a particularly interesting period to look at. So that's just one example of some of the work that will come out of my research here in the archives, showing her as an environmental writer, showing how thinking of her as an environmental writer puts her in a new light and gives us some more information about the environment that we might not otherwise have. And I have arguments like this about other writers, but now it being almost one, I should leave some time for Q&A, which I definitely invite whatever critiques, questions, severe undermining.